This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, a lot of people enjoy checking out books or maybe movies from their local libraries free of charge. Sometimes, if you really enjoy a book, you might go out and buy your own copy later. One Eau Claire-based art gallery has decided to take that library concept to the art world. Bill Henry Walker is the curator of the Artisan Forge Sculpture Park in Eau Claire and a sculpture artist. He's also the organizer of the Art Lending Library Program at Artisan Forge. He's joining us from our Eau Claire studio. Bill Henry, welcome to Central Time.
I'm great to be here.
What inspired you to try this art lending program?
Well, I met a short-tailed relative of mine in Minneapolis about a month and a half ago, and found that she was working in the same kind of program in Minneapolis. And when I heard about it, I said, that is so crazy. I wonder if it could work in Eau Claire. Now, of course, we have much different size markets. But I decided to put it to the artists at the Artisan Forge. And many of the artists said, hey, this is a great idea. Let's go for it. Let's see what we can do with it. So that's how it got started here. In Minneapolis, it started 6 years ago with three artists who decided to open up their little apartment, and they started loaning work out. And that program has grown over the last 6 years so that every 3 months they move 100 artworks into the public. And at the end of three months, the public bring the work back, or they purchase it, and they go on to the next into the next segment. So that program grew from just nothing to quite a movement of art, and we want to see that here in Eau Claire. It's starting small, and what we're discovering is that this is a word of mouth operation. People who borrow work decide, hey, this is such a great idea. They tell their friends, their neighbors. They have a painting for over the holidays, which they're proud to show, and the word gets out.
Now, I'd be a little nervous if I was borrowing art, a painting, or maybe one of your sculptures. I'd want to be really careful with it. I understand that part of the program is the artist actually comes in and helps set it up for them, so they're not fumbling around with nails and hammers.
I think this is really important. First of all, you get the artwork to their home and you install it. And the installing part is really important because, first of all, I want to see that painting displayed as well as possible. I don't want to see it crooked. I want to see it in the best possible spot. And, of course, this happened this last weekend where we went through three different places where this wonderful painting could be, and it was the last spot where the people said, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. And since then, the party has told me, this is a piece, I think we're going to keep this piece. And they've already told their friends and neighbors, they've already put it up on Facebook, and this is how the word gets out. So you're right, it can be a little nerve-wracking. This particular party said, well, if anything happens to the painting, we do have homeowners.
Now, talk about being an artist in Eau Claire. It's a great community for culture of all different kinds, but it's not a big city where you think of, people making great careers out of art. What is it like doing art in Eau Claire?
Well, of the three major art forms, music, theater, and the visual arts, certainly the first two are the most well-established. The visual arts come in a poor third, and it's really hard to make a living as an artist in Eau Claire. So most of the artists who are professionals have to take their work upstate, downstate, regionally, and in my case, I have taken my work to New York, to up and down the East Coast, down to Miami, and you have to find your markets elsewhere. Eau Claire is a very small community, and the people are just not used to having fine art, and the thought of fine art usually entails bigger bucks, and that sometimes is very off-putting.
If somebody's out there listening in the Eau Claire area, maybe they're an artist and they want to play along and have their art loaned out, or there's somebody who might be interested in borrowing art, how do they get involved?
Well, they basically have to stop by the Artisan Forge, which is on Claremont. And we have a sculpture park out front with a lot of sculptures. We have a new building, a lot of studios. We have a whole metal shop that's run by Greg Johnson. And they just have to stop by and tell us and make their art available to us. And it is a commitment on the artist's part to allow their work to be out of their inventory for 3 months. However, this is the way you get to meet people and start developing a community of people who appreciate art and who eventually will become collectors.
Do you feel as you're in the early days of this project, do you feel that community starting to come together around this?
I think so. We're getting artists who are willing to do this, and we're getting a few people who have already bought into this program and have taken work, and it's going to grow from here.
Bill Henry, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the project.
Great being here. Thank you very much.
Bill Henry Walker is the curator of the Artisan Forge Sculpture Park in Eau Claire and a sculpture artist. He joined us to talk about the Art Lending Library program he's organized at the Artisan Forge Gallery in Eau Claire. Before 1959, one Manitowoc-based company was known mostly for their pots and pans. With their new product, the aluminum specialty company had a new image, a glimmery, sometimes pink, aluminum Christmas tree. And many Americans wanted it, even a popular cartoon character.
Look, Charlie Brown, what do you want?
The proper mood. We need a Christmas tree.
Hey, perhaps a tree. A great, big, shiny aluminum Christmas tree. That's it, Charlie Brown. You get the tree. I'll handle this crowd.
Okay. I'll take Linus with me. The rest of you practice your lines.
Get the biggest aluminum tree you can find, Charlie Brown. Maybe paint it pink.
Yeah, do something right for a change, Charlie Brown.
Joe Kapler joins us for a look at Wisconsin's aluminum tree history. He's lead curator and curator of cultural history at the Wisconsin Historical Society. They are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Evergleam tree this year. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Always great to be back.
Let's get a little background. How was the aluminum tree idea born?
Sales manager for Aluminum Specialty Company of Manitowoc was down in Chicago, sees a shiny aluminum Christmas tree in a storefront window, looks at the price tag, says, we make aluminum toys and decorations besides pots and pans. I bet you we can do it better and more affordable. Grabbed one, took it back to Manitowoc. They reverse engineered it and in a couple of months' time made a better prototype.
And yeah, it was cheaper, but it was also way more portable, it sounds like.
For sure. They brought the cost down, materials, all that. And they made it easier for people to assemble and disassemble and reuse every year. That was the key.
And they pretty much created this aluminum tree market then, right? And it was really, there were other companies, but Manitowoc was the center of this.
Aluminum Specialty was first to the marketplace en masse. They were around for 50 years in 1959, so they had established distribution networks. They had sales relationships coast to coast, so they were at a nimble capacity in terms of retooling, and they could make these trees and get them into market quicker than anyone else.
So it was like other people had made cars. Henry Ford figured out how to make lots of cars for relatively cheap. Same thing with these aluminum trees here.
Very similar situation.
How did people respond to this product? Pretty different from the, cut tree you might put in your house.
Very different, and that was part of the appeal. For that slice of the marketplace, that slice of people who want something non-traditional, this appealed to them. The first sales had to be made to the Ben Franklin stores and to the Woolworth stores. They had to sell it to the buyers who had to know their customers, and they did it on a hunch, and they made a couple hundred thousand that first year before they sold one in a store.
Wow. And so they were big, and we heard that clip from Charlie Brown about the pink trees. Did that actually help sell even more of these for a while?
Some people like to point actually to that episode, 1965, as the beginning of the end of the aluminum Christmas
really?
Tree. Because Charlie, that's the impetus for him picking out the famous Charlie Brown, a very crummy natural tree is always better than an aluminum tree in Charlie Brown's eyes. I don't know that was the case because they still produced many different types and sold hundreds of thousands more after that show.
Ultimately, though, they did kind of go out of style, it sounds like.
Basically, at the end of the decade, ceased production in about 1971, 72 or so. So maybe a 12-year run.
Now, take us to 2019 and the Wisconsin Historical Society. You've managed to get a bunch of these aluminum trees, and that's not necessarily an easy job these days.
No. No one gives them away anymore. This is actually our 10th display of some kind featuring the Everglame tree. And this year we're marking the 60th anniversary, so bigger than better than ever. And we're having a special focus on the year 1959, what's happening in the movies and on TV, what's popular in stores. But yeah, you're right. We have to obtain trees kind of like everyone else, eBay.
How many trees do you end up with in this year's display?
So this year we have over 2024 trees, and we are appreciative that a lender has made some real great treasure trees, some of those real special rare ones, very hard to find, available. And you can see those in the glass cases at the museum's display.
What's our color range this year?
Blue-green to pink to all kinds of
you
different—
You did get the pink. Things.
Oh, for sure. pink is one of our treasured trees, and has a history of use in La Crosse, Wisconsin in the 1960s.
Right. This is an interesting postscript to the story, though. These are hard to get for you at the Historical Society because, you know, we're not buying them at the stores. We can't buy them in stores. Some people really want to get their hands on an Everglame tree.
Yeah, there's a finite number, even though millions were made, maybe more than one, maybe 3 million. There's a finite number. And with, you know, online social media, people can find out in a hurry what they have and discover that there is a robust online marketplace.
Well, it's got to drive you a little nuts, though, because I'm guessing that in attics and basements and barns and garages around the state, there have got to be a lot of these things hiding out there still.
Around the state and around the country, for sure. People will discover them. The irony of all this is that they were affordably made. Scotch tape, aluminum foil, simple wooden dowels. Yet today, they're highly treasured, and they sell for a rate far greater than their original sales price.
Well, I love this because it's cultural history for sure, and this great artifact. It's also part of Wisconsin's business and economic history.
That's really the reason why we're doing it and why we have for all these years. This is a great story, Wisconsin's story of this innovative and adaptive business centered in East Central Wisconsin. And you think of Luma Specialty Company and this other company called Miro, the world's largest maker of aluminum housewares. Incredible contribution kind of to that domestic good life made accessible to many Americans throughout the 1900s.
Evergleaming is the exhibit. Tell people how they can check it out online and in person.
Online, certainly wisconsinhistory.org. We have some features loaded up on our site, as well as the exhibition on first floor of the Wisconsin Historical Museum on Wisconsin's Capitol Square. We have extended holiday hours Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and special Sunday hours, 11 to 4, up until Christmas Eve. And of course, this year, we have special merchandise, custom merchandise, available in our museum store as well.
And before I let you go, Joe, I understand people didn't necessarily decorate these by putting stuff on them. Sometimes they just made sure they had the right light shining on them, so they gleamed just right.
The whole notion was to projected color light onto these trees and even to activate them by putting them on a rotating stand. You look at the historical photographic record, it would appear that most people just hung ornaments on them. They certainly didn't hang electric lights.
And how did you tackle it in your exhibit?
We put the colored light on them, or overhead display light.
As nature intended.
As intended.
Joe, thank you so much for being with us again.
You're very welcome.
That's Joe Kapler, lead curator and curator of cultural history at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He's put together the exhibit we've been talking about, Everglaming, 60 Years of America's Aluminum Christmas Tree. It's on view until Saturday, January 4th at the Historical Society. President Trump announced yesterday that his administration would reinstate tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum from Brazil and Argentina. The president argued via tweet that both countries had hurt American farmers by artificially devaluing their currency. These tariffs are the latest in an ongoing trade dispute between the United States and many international trading partners. Our next guest joins us now to talk about these latest tariffs, what a trade war between the U.S. and South American countries could look like, and the overall impact tariffs have on international relations. Mark Koplovich is a professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
What's the significance here, Brazilian and Argentinian steel and aluminum? How big a deal is the tariff on those products?
It's a fairly big deal. They're actually two of the, I believe, five largest exporters of steel into the United States. What's happened more broadly is a year ago spring, in March of 2018, the president, under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, has the authority, in conjunction with the Commerce Department, to impose tariffs for reasons of national security. So they were imposed on a bunch of our close allies: Canada, European Union, Australia, Argentina, Brazil. Argentina and Brazil were exempted from those in exchange for quantitative restrictions or quotas, what are euphemistically known as voluntary export restraints. And what's happened now is the Trump administration has announced that they're going to replace those quotas, going back to putting the 25% tariffs on steel.
Let's give a listen to President Trump talking about why he's doing this now.
Well, Brazil has really discounted. If you take a look at what's happened with their currency, they've devalued their currency very substantially by 10%. Argentina also. And I gave them a big break on tariffs, but now I'm taking that break off because it's very unfair to our manufacturers and very unfair to our farmers. Our steel companies will be very happy, and our farmers will be very happy.
All right, so the president arguing, okay, these countries have devalued their currency. That makes the dollar stronger compared to them. But their currency has been devalued. It's true. Are they artificially doing it as a trade strategy here?
No, absolutely not. In fact, both of them are facing very serious economic times. So Argentina is on the brink of a serious debt and financial crisis. Their currency has fallen 60% in value. They've actually been trying to defend the level of the currency against the dollar, and they're running out of foreign exchange reserves. Brazil's been running major trade deficits and facing an economic slowdown for several years now. So currencies rise and fall in global markets for lots of reasons, and what's going on here is the state of the Brazilian and Argentine economies are not good, and the currencies are falling in the value of the dollar. The kernel of truth in there is that the decline in the currency values does offset some of the tariffs.
Now, he mentioned manufacturers. He also mentioned farmers. And that's part of the story here, as I understand it, especially with Brazil. Check me on this. It gets complicated. We're in a trade dispute with China.
Yes.
China doesn't want to buy our soybeans as a punitive tool against us for other tariffs. So they're going to countries like Brazil.
Yes.
Is that part of why the president is then targeting this third party as part of our trade dispute with China?
Yes. So we have the bigger ongoing trade war with China. The retaliatory tariffs that China put in place when we imposed tariffs on them were targeted at certain sensitive industries, and soybean exports were one of them. Brazil is our largest competitor in global markets, as another one of the large soybean exporters. And so there's been a big shift from soybean purchases by China from the United States towards Brazil. So this is kind of how it all gets tied in here. The irony, of course, is that the trade war was started by the Trump administration. So we're sort of getting a retaliation to the retaliation to the retaliation.
Now, we've seen tariffs on steel and aluminum from a lot of countries. Brazil and Argentina got a break for a while. What has been the impact on U.S. steel, the U.S. steel industry, of these tariffs? Because we think steel is one product. It's a lot of different products, right?
It's a lot of different products. And also, it's, you know, the decline of the steel industry is part of a 50-year-long trend of structural transformation of the U.S. economy, deindustrialization. And so when the steel tariffs were initially announced, there were some fairly ambitious numbers of, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of jobs that were going to be saved. The news recently we've seen is that basically the tariffs haven't helped arrest the decline of steel. What they have done, because Americans are paying the tariffs, is, you know, American firms and consumers are paying the tariffs, is they've raised prices, right? So they've had a broader negative effect on the U.S. economy without the hoped for and promised, being a saving grace for the steel industry.
Right. The president has pointed toward money that the U.S. government has raised from tariffs. Who is that money being paid by?
It's being paid by Americans that are importing goods, right? So you can think about, the first place that you see it is American firms that are importing steel and aluminum as inputs into production, Either they're purchasing American steel, which is now higher priced, or they're importing steel that previously wasn't tariffed. And so the inputs of production are raising costs of production. So that's hurting American firms. And some portion of those price increases then also get passed on to American consumers in the form of higher prices at retail.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison about the latest tariffs from the Trump administration and international trade. Mark, when we called you about Brazil and Argentina. Since then, China and France are big in the news, too. Let's start in China. Now, the president's saying today, we've got these negotiations going on with China. They may not get resolved until after Election Day 2020.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, these negotiations have been going on, but from my perspective, at least, it's never been really clear what the goal of the negotiations. Normally, when you have trade negotiations between countries, the idea is we're going to sign a comprehensive free trade agreement. We have certain sectors we're negotiating on. There's a general sense from the Trump administration and Bob Lighthizer, who's the U.S. trade representative, that China engages in lots of unfair trade practices, and we want to transform we want to transform the U.S.-China trade relationship. But there hasn't been very clear articulations of exactly what we want to do. And so the negotiations have been going on and on and on without a kind of clear endpoint. And there's been a lot of we're close to a deal type of announcements, but very few details. So the announcement now is we might wait to announce what the deal is, but there's been very little information about why we're so close or what exactly it is that we're so close on at this point.
And there's been talk of phase one, as I understand it, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the early stages of this negotiation now are just to get back to where we started before we started having these back and forth retaliatory tariffs.
It looks like that's what's going to happen because we're sort of talking about, okay, now China will specify how many agricultural products they will buy, or we might repeal some of the tariffs in exchange for agricultural product purchases. But that does in many ways just get us back to the status quo of, say, 2016, 2017, not to kind of a transformation of the relationship.
Okay, now let's take things. That's China. Let's go to France now. President Trump talking about France imposing taxes on American technology companies, threatening tariffs. Here's a little listen to President Trump talking about this in a joint meeting. This is in front of the French President Emmanuel Macron.
I think we'll be able to work something out, I hope. And maybe not. Maybe we'll do it through taxing. You know, we can work it out easily through taxing. But the techs, you know, they're American companies, the tech companies that you're talking about. They're not my favorite people because they're not exactly for me, but that's okay. I don't care. They're American companies. And we want to tax American companies, so that's important. We want to tax them. That's not for somebody else to tax them. And as the president knows, we tax wine and we have other taxes scheduled. But we'd rather not do that. But that's the way it would work. So it's either going to work out or we'll work out some mutually beneficial tax. And the tax will be substantial. And I'm not sure it's going to come to that, but it might.
Okay, sort this one out for us.
So France announced that they're going to impose a digital services tax on American technology companies, so Amazon, Google, Apple, et cetera. As you've probably heard, there's a lot of concern that these companies have a lot of their money and their profits in tax havens, you know, such as the Cayman Islands, and don't pay a lot. It turns out they pay very little income tax. And so there's been discussion amongst the industrialized countries at the OECD in Paris, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, about a universal tax to try and address the tax haven issue. This digital services tax that France has talked about imposing is sort of a stopgap to this broader multilateral agreement. And so the Trump administration is unhappy with that. They see it as American firms being unfairly targeted. And the retaliatory tariffs that they've talked about putting on things like sparkling wine and cheese and whatnot are in response to the unhappiness about the digital services tax.
Is the digital services tax so much different? I know it's digital, but you know, if Ford goes to France and sells cars, France is going to tax the cars. Is that analogous? Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think so. And again, it's a sort of cross national issue because most of these companies are doing business all over the world, right? So you have Google, Amazon, Apple, et cetera. They're doing business in a bunch of EU countries, in Canada, and the United States. And so, how you tax multinational corporations is a thorny issue. One better settled with some sort of multilateral agreement rather than maybe a national tax by one country. But there's a lot of sense, I think, in France and other EU countries that the U.S. hasn't on its own done much to address this. And so the Macron administration, I think, is trying to force the issue a little bit.
Let's go back to the core here that unites all these issues with Brazil, Argentina, China, and France, the use of tariffs as an international policy tool.
Yes, it's a sort of return to a world that we in many ways had thought we had left of thinking about kind of mercantilism and aggressive trade policy. Bilateral relationships, right? So sort of singling out relationships with one country and using tariffs to try and get one country to trade to change their policies. It's part of a broader dissatisfaction of the Trump administration and the officials in the administration like Bob Lighthizer, who are not strong supporters of the World Trade Organization and multilateral trade negotiations. And so it's kind of using U.S. economic power and size and throwing our weight around and not really using multilateral trade institutions to try and get what we want.
Are other countries following suit now?
Yes and no. I mean, so in direct response to us, you have seen the EU, you've seen Canada, you've seen the Chinese responding to us. But the other thing that you're seeing going on right now is the rest of the world is moving on without us. Right. So you recall we backed out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The other 11 countries went on and signed what they called the CPTPP. The EU has now in the last 2 years signed trade agreements with Canada and Japan. And so the rest of the world is moving on with more trade liberalization. And the U.S. and to some extent the U.K. are kind of the ones that are turning inward. We've traditionally been the country that has been most strongly supporting globalization and free trade over the last 70 years. So there's a question about the future of things like the WTO and multilateral trade openness.
Lots to watch in the days to come. Mark, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
That's Mark Koplovich, professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joins today to talk about the tariffs President Trump announced would be put into place against Brazil and Argentina, now also France, and the impact these moves could have on international trade.